Thank you, Madam Speaker. We are, Madam Speaker, on the eve of a general election. It could be delayed, but it cannot be stopped. As a member for Castries East put it yesterday, this may well be the last budget addressed for some in this House. Inevitably, there was speculation that this would be an election budget, meaning a budget littered with projects aimed at rescuing a beleaguered, bruised, and battered government. On the face of it, this does not appear to have happened. Some may well have been disappointed. But should they? The more discerning may not be unhappy at all. Why? They know that this budget will not disappoint because it conceals huge allocations of borrowed money to be spent at the discretion primarily of two individuals, namely the Prime Minister and Member for Castries North, and Minister of Communications and Works, the Member for Castries South. A simple look at the capital estimates tells the story. The Member for Castries South East has been given $103,149,479 to spend this financial year. Under the line item Disaster Recovery Program, the minister is allocated $24,165,000. Not a single project is defined under this program. He is at large, unchained, unrestrained. The Prime Minister and the Minister of Finance is not to be outdone. He has given his Ministry of Finance, Economic Affairs and National Development a total of $101,819,583 to spend this financial year. Again, an allocation of $11,063,403 is made to a National Reconstruction and Development Program. Not a single sub-project is identified under that line item. No definition, no specificity. The Prime Minister and Minister of Communications and Works will together control $204,969,062 of the total capital allocation. All of these items are funded from the record loan of $322,315,400 to be procured by the government. No doubt, more opportunities exist to dishing out contracts by direct purchase. As Willie James would say in times past, this is where the action is. The tragedy is that a historic opportunity has been missed. This budget presented a historic opportunity for the government to outline its vision for the people of the future. Outlining a grand vision was particularly important given the difficult 12 months which this country has had to endure, escalating crime and then the terrible effects of one of the most damaging natural disasters in the history of this country. At this point, a clear vision of the type of country which we envisage for the people of Tikloosha and the path to that goal should have been clearly outlined. How do we move our country to the next level, to higher middle income status. How do we rebuild our infrastructure to be more resilient to natural disasters? How do we keep our talented young people occupied by providing the right type of education and employment opportunities? This was the opportune time for the government to lay out this vision. Instead, what we have is a piecemeal budget, a hodgepodge, which lacks the coherent and integrated vision of how the country or how the year-to-year policies fit in a broader development agenda for this country. However, it's really not surprising that we have been presented with another spending plan which lacks any connection to a grand vision. I call it a spending plan because this is consistent with how this government has operated over the past four parliaments. Tax, borrow, and spend. With little long-term planning while unemployment continues to rise. So, if this is a budget without soul, without spirit, without character, without definition, it is not difficult to understand. Throughout the entire presentation by the member for Castries North, his colleagues around the table only clapped once when a reduction of $5 was announced on small cylinders. Only once. Of course, they gave the customary applause at the end of it all. What does that tell you? The message. If the people of St. Lucia sought help, if they looked for mercy, if they asked for solace, and if they pleaded for reassurance in these troubled times, then they found none, and they got none. Nowhere was the character of this budget better exposed than the issue of fight for fuel. This was the crowning statement of the Minister of Finance. Quote, Madam Speaker, while government has heard the concerns of the public, fuel prices are determined by global market forces outside of St. Lucia, over which we have no control, unquote. Mind you, when we speak of global prices, and we are supposed to speak about global prices, we sometimes forget that the supplier of our fuel is none other than Trinidad and Tobago. But Madam Speaker, who has ever said that the government controls the global price of fuel? No one denies that global prices will influence the price of gas at the pump. But the reality is that the final price at the pump is dictated by one authority, the government of St. Lucia. That is why you have changes every month. The final price is determined by the various charges and taxes the government imposes and the frequency with which it chooses to adjust prices. We say the tax on gas is too high. We say it is extortion. Many people believe that it is only $3 of consumption tax that the government collects on every gallon of gasoline and diesel. This is not really accurate because there is an additional 5% on cost, insurance, and freight, what we call CIS, as service charge on every gallon. In the present circumstances, the 5% service charge is equivalent to an additional 67 cents on every gallon of fuel. Therefore, the government collects $3.67 on every gallon of fuel, not, as is commonly believed, $3. What is more unpardonable is the fact that the amount the government receives in taxes on every gallon of gas and diesel has been increasing on a monthly basis. As the landing cost, CIF, increases, the 5% service charge increases in real terms. So, for example, in March 2011, the government taxes on every gallon of fuel was $3.44. In April, it increased to $3.67. We said two things. First, the government must reduce the taxes it collects on fuel to bring it in line with what was agreed when the pass-through mechanism was created. It was agreed at the time that no more than $2 would be collected as consumption tax. That is what convention does. Secondly, we say that it is madness to adjust the prices every month. There is too much movement, too much volatility, too much unpredictability, too much uncertainty. Instead, let us shift to a system of adjustment every 3 months, based on an average movement in prices over the period. No one, certainly on this side of the house, has ever suggested that we abandon the pass-through mechanism. These adjustments will put us in a similar situation as convincing where the excise tax is $2 per gallon. In convincing, the customs service charge is 37 cents per gallon. So at the fuel pumps in convention, the current prices are as follows. A liter of gasoline, $13.60. Diesel, $12.51. Kerosene, $12.18. Now, Madam Speaker, if your economy has grown by 4.4% as you claim, and it is programmed to grow another 4.5% next financial year, then how do you continue to justify this outrageous taxation on fuel? When we engage in excessive taxation, it is inevitable that questions would be raised about what we do with tax revenue. How can this government justify such taxes, given the rip-off and wastage on the Daher Mall project and the rental of office space at Baywalk for the Ministry of External Affairs? For over 1 year now, the Ministries of Labour and Social Transformation have been paying the owners of Huanoro House rent for the space which they lease, and are yet to occupy that space. Allow me, Madam Speaker, to pause for a moment and dwell on the Daher Mall. The tenders for the Daher Mall was opened some time ago. One of the government's favorite contractors, the political commentator, Cyril Donnelly, came in at $53 million, the lowest tender. So, with a purchase price of $33 million and a retrofitting cost, by Donnelly's calculations, of $53 million, and the expected fees for consultants and the like, it would mean that over $100 million would be spent on that building. All of it borrowed, every cent of it. It's a staggering amount, isn't it? More importantly, after construction, probably create jobs of 5 janitors and 5 security officers. What a boost to the employment situation from such a massive investment. In the midst of our world with fuel prices, we are told that our economy grew by 4.4%. If St. Lucia has entered positive growth territory, then all citizens should rejoice. Follow us. As a recession hurts everyone, especially the poor and vulnerable in society, there are no signs that unemployment is declining or corporate profitability is rising. This is not surprising, given that this government has no effective strategy for dealing with this core issue. The question is this: how could you, Mr. Prime Minister, look at the people of St. Lucia, albeit from the safety of this chamber, and tell them that the economy grew by 4.4% last year? How believable is this? When your economic and social review discloses the following: value added in agriculture, in the agricultural sector, contracted further by 15.7%. This followed a decline of 5.4% the previous year. This statement is found at page 14. Now, may I pause, Madam Speaker, to say that despite all the championing of the Minister of Agriculture, he is the worst performing Minister of Agriculture ever in recent times. Ever! The statistics are there. So successive declines in output and in production. Decreases in value added were also recorded for other crops and fishery subsectors of 8% and 2.8% respectively. Again, see page 2. Total fish landings decreased by 3.1%, page 16. Value added in manufacturing sector decreased by 4%, page 2. The rate of inflation increased to 1.9% compared to 1% a year earlier, page 3. Hotel occupancy was weighed down by the consistently low rates posted by some hotels. The member from Meeker South explained the dilemma. You have the numbers, but you don't get the income because of heavy discounting. Cruise arrivals declined by 4.2%, page 13. Value added in the transport sector decelerated to 1.8% in 2010, page 24. Total outstanding public debt increased by 11.4%. That is up to December 2010, page 38. Curiously, despite the fact that this is April, this figure does not include the debt incurred since January 2011. Don't forget it for a moment. We shall come back to that. Fiscal performance of the central government deteriorated in the 2010-2011 fiscal year, registering, if the figure is to be believed, an overall deficit of $174.4 million of 5.5% of GDP. Translated, we can't pay our bills. Got to borrow, and borrow heavily, to meet our recurring costs. That's what it means. Then here, steep rise in the level of commercial banks' non-performing loans, reflecting increases in loan delinquencies, page 12. These are the ills your own social and economic report has told you about the economy. This is what they say. I didn't invent it. All of what I have said everything contained here follows a negative growth of 5.2% in 2010. The question that faces us, all of us, is how in the face of all of these negative indicators, this economy could have grown by 4.4%. How is that possible? On February 13, 2011, Prime Minister, in a speech to the nation, said the following, and I quote it. Saint Lucia's economy was well on its way to recovery in 2010. Before Hurricane Thomas almost completely reversed the progress that had been made. In fact, based on preliminary estimates, St. Lucia's real GDP growth for 2010 was projected at 1.7% just prior to the hurricane, based on actual performance during the first 9 months of 2010 and projections for the final 3 months of the year. By my count, February 13th, March 13th, April 13th, 2 months. A dramatic change. A dramatic change in growth prospects. But that's not all. The ECLAC reports, which you quoted, Mr. Prime Minister, on the damage and losses caused by Hurricane Thomas, reported as follows. Quote, the economic performance of St. Lucia in the recent past, 2006-2009, may be characterized as moderate and losing momentum, with real gross domestic product GDP decreasing from 4.8% in 2006 to 0.7% in 2008 and negative 5.2% in 2009. Then they asked a crucial line. The economy was projected to grow by 1.4% in 2010. Projected, not actual. It begs the question, therefore, that if in December 2010, the government could have reported to the ECLAC team during their assessment that GDP growth for 2010 would be 1.4%, which in itself sounds inflated, how can the same government 4 months later, with economic activity further depressed by Hurricane Thomas, quote a GDP growth of 4.4%. Did you make a mistake then, Prime Minister? Or are you a magician? What is it? It is true, and I concede, that the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank came to your rescue, and that of other OECD economies, and did an exercise to recalculate GDP figures. The initial study was done by Father out of Barbados. The Eastern Caribbean Central Bank decided to revise or rebase the national accounts to improve relevance and their accuracy by changing the base year of calculation from 1990 to 2006. In other words, all GDP calculations should theoretically start at 2006. As far as I'm aware, the revision has been done for the period 2000 to 2009 and not the year 2010. As a result of the rebase figures, the nominal level of GDP has increased in all member states of the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank, and their debt GDP ratios have fallen because of the increased GDP. You know, you could have explained and spared yourself this self-inflicted embarrassment and take the debate to another level. No, it was too much to do. You chose not to do it because if you did, then you would have to record growth rates achieved by the former SLC government. Under the revised grace, these would be the growth rates which you would have inherited. In 2001, admittedly, negative 4.97%. In 2002, 1.9. In 2003, 8.17. In 2004, 9.43. In 2005, 5.56%. And in 2006, 11.25. In other words, between 2001 and 2006, St. Lucia would have experienced over a five-year cycle of the government an average growth rate of 5.22%, with the highest growth rate of 11.25% in 2006, and if I am correct, and assuming the integrity of these rebate figures, if I am correct, and assuming the integrity of these rebate figures, it would be one of the highest growth rates. Yes. We'll have time to talk back. It also means that overall, as the member for Class 3Ds pointed out, some such 1.34% growth was contributed to GDP of the country in that five-year cycle. Ladies and gentlemen, honorable members, honorable members, am I able to talk? I didn't want to intend to be distracted. But look, I'm going to pass this around. And somebody give this to the member for Catholic Church. By the way, the page number is page 1. There's a figure of 4.4% credible. That's the question. The International Monetary Fund World Economic Outlook of April 2001 indicated that the economy of St. Lucia registered a growth rate of 0.8% in 2010. According to the Eastern Caribbean Online Economic Report, economic activity in St. Lucia is estimated to have been flat in the first 6 months of 2010 relative to the outset in the corresponding period of 2009, unquote. If one has to take into account the damage caused by Hurricane Thomas in October 2010, then economic activity would have remained largely subdued in the last quarter of 2010. Consequently, it is highly unlikely that the economy would have generated enough growth in the third quarter. In the third quarter of the year, which incidentally is not the peak tourism season, to register an annual growth rate of 4.4%. When all is said and done, the rate of growth last year seems to be driven in part by the statistical changes associated with the rebasing of GDP, and also the fact that the decline in the previous year was far greater than that suggested during the old base year. To properly analyze the Prime Minister's claim, the Minister of Finance had a duty. He was duty bound present data on what GDP would have been under the old base year compared to the new one. If you want to be believed, then you must present both series side by side. It is incredulous that the Minister of Finance, a member for Class 3 North, would take credit for a growth rate which was largely due to adjustments in statistics to reflect more relevant underlying trends in the economy. The fact is to say, only time will tell. That is very interesting to see whether the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank put its reputation on the line when it finally publishes the figures. It is issues such as these which have led to our current predicament. The harsh truth is that the people of Sintisha do not have any confidence in the leadership of this government, and in particular the Minister of Finance. This was the point made by the member for Kashmir yesterday. It is worth revisiting one of the questions posed to St. Lucians as well as other citizens of CARICOM in the survey made a document in this house by the member for Kashmir and engaged in a comparative analysis of the response. I am not going in the same direction as the member for Kashmir. I am going to make a comparative analysis of what was described, as you heard, as a brief report. The respondents were asked to rate the current policies of their government, whether we're on this side or on that side, with elections approaching and decisions have to be made about this country, we all should be worried by how solutions are thinking at this time. This was the question. As to the economic policies of the government, would you say the government is doing a good job, only fair or a poor job? This is what the researchers wrote. Quote, on average, only 14% of consumers thought their government was doing a good job in terms of economic policy. Respondents in St. Vincent and the Grenadines, in the land of the comrades, those are my words, Barbados and Grenada gave the highest marks to current government economic policies in that a majority of respondents rated government's economic policy as good or only fair. Jamaica respondents gave the lowest grade on government economic policies, and over 50% of respondents in St. Kitts and Nevis, St. Lucia and Trinidad and Tobago thought government economic policies were poor. And if we look at it a little more closely, doing a good job, Antigua 8.4%, Barbados 19.3%, Dominica 17.7%, Grenada 9.6%, Guyana 11.1%, Jamaica 2%, St. Lucia 2.5%, St. Vincent 30.8%, St. Kitts 8%, Trinidad and Tobago 5%. Only a fair job. CARICOM average 38.8%, Antigua 32.3%, Barbados 44.5%, Dominica 29.5%, Grenada 54.7%, Guyana 39.3%, Jamaica 30.7%, St. Lucia 37.5%, St. Vincent 37.1%, St. Kitts 31.2%, Trinidad and Tobago 37.8%. A poor job. CARICOM as a whole 38.8%. Antigua 46.5%, Barbados 25.5%, Dominica 42.6%, Grenada 35.1%, Guyana 43%, Jamaica 63%, St. Lucia 51.9%, St. Vincent 25.5%, St. Kitts 55.6%, Trinidad and Tobago 50.5%. And those who don't know, CARICOM has a whole 8%, Antigua 12.5%, Barbados 10.7%, Dominica 10.3%, Grenada 0.7%, Guyana 6.6%, Jamaica 4%, St. Lucia 7.8%, St. Vincent 6.5%, St. Kitts 5.2%, and Trinidad and Tobago 6.4%. Issues like this will continue to arise so long as this government continues to operate surreptitiously and covertly. Just last month, March 2011, the Treasury Department, in a covert operation for the salary increase of 36.5% on the basic salary of employees of grades 19, 20, and 21, permanent secretaries, deputy permanent secretaries, and the like. The basic salaries increased as follows. Grade 19 from $6,300 a month, $8,599.50 monthly. Grade 20 from $7,200 a month to $9,828 monthly. And grade 21 from $9,400 a month to $12,831 monthly. We are aware that a salary increase for officers of these grades and parliamentarians comes on the basis of a report of recommendations from the Salary Reviews Commission, a point adopted by the Parliament Exclusive after consultation with Cabinet of Ministers. And I want to make it absolutely clear that the salaries of parliamentarians have not been increased. We are talking of senior management of the public service. We are not aware that any such report has been laid and adopted by the Parliament of St. Lucia. Therefore, under whose and what authority was the salary increase paid by the Treasury Department? Secondly, it has been noticed that in the monthly salary pay range schedule on page 565 of the estimate, the basic salaries for employees of grades 19, 20, and 21 were changed to reflect the increase, but there was no concomitant changes or increases under the staff position schedule for any ministry, department, or officers of these grades. In other words, there appears to be no provision for the salary increase. Or is it hidden somewhere? If so, then why? There was a provision for retroactive wage settlement of $9,537,787 in the 2010-2011 estimate. Did the government expend these funds, and if the funds were expended, which categories of workers were paid? It is rather unusual and strange, and it defies best practices in budget preparation to have an object classified described as follows. This is in the estimate. 119, reserve, fund reserve for particular purposes. Never heard of the description in the estimate of expenditure. So uncertain, so vague, so undefined. Pray, what on earth is this? What are these particular purposes? It is understandable and accepted international practice to have an expenditure classification for contingencies. And rightly so, a provision of $6 million under the Office of the Budget Program. However, there is a provision of $7,531,391 as reserve funds reserved for particular purposes. There was also an amount of $5,766,330. Again, what particular purposes are these? There are no provisions under Financial Regulation 36.1 for the Minister of Finance to reserve an item of for expenditure. In the general warrant, a provisional general warrant, after the passage of the Appropriation Act, but not in the estimate of expenditure. This practice is clearly not in keeping with the provisions of the Finance Act and its attendant regulations. Further, it defeats the whole purpose of a budget. A budget is supposed to give full details of the projects and programs that are to be executed and implemented for the financial year. In addition, that practice opens an avenue to manipulate usage of budgetary provisions. We all understand what contingencies mean. We all do so. For what particular purposes? Why are we, after several years of schooling public officers in budgetary practices, after exporting what we have created and established, engaged in such behavior at this time. Chickens are finally coming home to roost. I recall the debate when growth figures achieved by the former administration was ridiculed by the members of the Senate, drawn that such growth was not real growth because it was fueled by debt. I wonder what he thinks now. No government has borrowed as much money in a 5-year term as this government. No government. And I am on record as saying that I do not crucify the government for borrowing for reconstruction purposes. That's legitimate. There was no choice. The government planned to borrow a total of $322,315,400 to finance this budget. Over the past 4 years, this government has borrowed $754 million, made up as follows. In 2007, $216 million. In 2008, $116 million. In 2009, $130 million. In 2010, $293 million. So this must be added the sum of $322.3 million to be borrowed this year. This totals $1,076,000,000. $1,076,000,000. When this total is added to the $537 million borrowed or to be borrowed by Schlasfer for the Huanura Airport project, it would mean that in 1 year, this country as a whole, this year's figures and the accumulation would be borrowing close to about $1.6 billion. No matter how this government and Schlasfer tries to spin the planned borrowing allegedly by Schlasfer, it will have to be included on the government books, which would increase the debt by more than 10% of GDP. And yet, there are some who champion it and who say that it is good for the country. It is in that context that the debt to be incurred for the airport project must be analyzed. We have said that while we accept that some upgrading is necessary at Huanura Airport, what is contemplated cannot be justified at this time. We believe that our scarce resources should go to reconstruction of our country. We believe that the system of procurement adopted by Schlasfer was flawed. How can anyone justify the selection of Delance as a principal contractor, given its skirmishes with the court and its total inexperience in construction airport terminals? I see no more for the time being, because more will be said of this at the right time. There is one piece of advice I will offer, not to the government, but to Schlasfer, its board, and its officials. Make sure that the legal arrangements underpinning the financing arrangements for that airport are beyond reproach. Section 26 of the Airport Air and Seaport Authority Act allows Schlasfer to raise loans, quote, with the consent of the minister from any source. Section 28 allows Parliament to guarantee loans. Slasper. Question which Slasper must ponder for the sake of the people of this country. Not, I repeat, for the sake of this government, is whether by enacting a law to compel St. Lucians and visitors to St. Lucia to pay US $35 when they travel, government is impliedly guaranteeing payment to the investors and so granting indirectly a guarantee without parliamentary approval. Madam Speaker, I take it that those who chose or choose to invest in this project will do so with their eyes wide open. And they fully understand that their investments must rise and fall with the so-called lost box arrangement. That the people of St. Lucia will not be called upon to make any payment out of the consolidated fund. If and when there is default in the repayment of any principal or the payment of any interest or other charges incurred as a result of this loan, I call on the Minister of Finance to give this up, this categorical assurance to the. But the questions remain. How can we justify this expenditure when our people cannot access health care because they cannot pay for it? When we beg foreign hospitals to treat our people? When we have a monumental job for reconstructing our country after Hurricane Thomas? Madam Speaker, this budget is extraordinary. It is unique. It is truly incomprehensible. How could this government prepare a budget in the midst of a recession, in the aftermath of a major hurricane, and yet not give any direction or support or mention or encouragement to the private sector? Is the private sector of the Lucia dead? Is there no place for it? The private sector of this country is obviously struggling. Companies are scaling daily. Many companies are shedding employees. The data on private sector credit confirms the difficulties of the private sector. Credit to the private sector in 2010 was virtually stagnant, growing by little over 1%. In our system, credit growth gives one a fair indication of how companies and consumers are coping. When the economy is strong and vibrant and unemployment declining, credit growth is usually strong and a leading indicator of development in the country. If the domestic economy is struggling, firms do not expand their operations. The weak credit growth suggests that most companies are struggling. While the private sector is struggling, the government is borrowing heavily, over $322 million this financial year, extracting more resources which in theory ought to be available to the private sector. You cannot develop an economy solely on government spending. So, Mr. Prime Minister, what's the plan? Where are we going, Mr. Prime Minister? No plan, Mr. Prime Minister? The return to a growth trajectory is true. No matter how slight it may be, is, as I said, very welcome. But you know what? I'm a member for Meeko North. Put a finger on it. What's the average solution really care about a job? That's what they care about. At the end of the day, what masses of unemployed mothers and of thousands of young people graduating from school is whether jobs are available. The budget is shocking in the lack of attention paid to this critical issue. I for one understand the embarrassment of the government. Embarrassment to talk about jobs, especially after promising 7,000 jobs in their manifesto and the last general election campaign. 7,000 jobs that never materialized and cannot and will not materialize before general election. But you always was. You know, sometimes that doubt may exist about the reliability of the statistics coming from the Department of Statistics. You know that. Because it takes time. But surely you can give us some indication of what is the current level of unemployment. For starters, how many new jobs were created in 2010? How were the benefits of the alleged growth of 4.4% distributed? What really is the government's strategy in dealing with the chronically high levels of employment in this country? It is silence. Why the wall of silence? Why? There are some things we can do to tackle the scourge of unemployment. The harsh reality is, or welcome reality for that matter, depending on how you argue, new employment can only come from new investment, whether by local businesses or by foreign capital. The search for new forms of investment must be our unrelenting mission. We have to consider new forms of investment if we are to survive. We can no longer rely on the traditional forms of investment. In all of this, we need to give the private sector some elbow room to invest. We need to excite them. We need to encourage them. We have to understand, all of us, that we are on our own. And understandably, there will be this different descriptions, whatever the case might be, as to the policies which can be adopted. But as I have said before, Madam Speaker, an SLP administration will reduce the rate of corporate tax for large businesses from 30% to 25%, and similarly, reduce the rate of corporate tax on small and medium-sized businesses from 30% to 20%. We reduced it from 33.3% in the last term of our government to 30%. That's the history. The need to create jobs must be our mantra. Quote, deceased Prime Minister David Thompson in another context, Madam Speaker, jobs must be our number one priority, our number two priority, and our number three priority. That is why an SLP administration will promote alternative policy. That is why we will give consideration to the introduction of an employment tax credit. This system will give tax credits to businesses that generate new employment. We therefore propose to grant 1 year free of tax to new companies that employ at least 6 persons who are paid over $20,000, $24,000 each per annum. And 2 years free of tax to new companies that employ 10 persons who are paid over $24,000 each per annum. These are the kinds of policies that we need to explore in these troubled times. But in this season, in this budget, the people of this country are told that they must pay a national security level of 1% of the CIS value of selected items imported into the position. Another tax. Not all the selected items, but advise that it's a one-off tax for 1 year only. This tax comes in addition to the usual taxes imposed in 2006. But for the moment, I'll confine it to the tax paid for the importation of any goods. That is to say, duty consumption tax to the charge for environmental levy. And very soon we will have to pay the airport development tax of US$35 when we travel. Over the past 4 years, we have seen the imposition of vehicle licenses of $150, increases to departure taxes to US, I think it is $25 if I'm correct, increases to the price of fuel, reductions in the income tax deductions for house repairs to only $10,000, and a mortgage interest to a maximum of only $13,000. That's the property tax on the side, because this year I noticed the budget makes an allowance for a steep increase in property tax, so leave it at the end. All of these increases have come before what is proposed to be the inevitable imposition of that. We must not and cannot allow this country to be suffocated by taxation. In this period of recovery, I too understand that it is vital that we maximize revenue intake. I understand that. But we must do so by not engaging in the oppressive behavior that has become the norm in recent times. These days it has become normal for the Inland Revenue Department to invade the accounts of private citizens with the willing cooperation of some banks. Apparently the privacy of accounts of citizens can no longer be guaranteed. And this is happening without a court order. I'm not blaming anyone, because the income tax law has been part of our law now for a substantial period of time. Madam Speaker, no taxation system should be based on fair intimidation and oppressive behavior. The tax system should encourage entrepreneurship and the creation of new areas of employment.
As a member, you have 10 more minutes to complete your presentation.
Madam Speaker, I'd like to move that in both sections we intend to allow the members for the consultation.
Honourable members, the question is that Standing Order 5010 be invoked in order to allow Honourable Member from Newport South an additional 60 minutes to complete. In order to allow Honourable Member from Newport South an additional 60 minutes to complete his presentation. I now put the question, as many as are of that opinion, say aye. As many as are of the contrary opinion, say no. I think the ayes have it, Honourable Member, you need to.
Madam Speaker, I stopped at the point where I said that no taxation system should be based on fear, intimidation, and oppressive behavior. The tax system should encourage entrepreneurship and the creation of new areas of employment, provide relief for those who need it the most, and provide a sustainable revenue base that will allow the government a range of services to its citizens. What are some alternatives in these trying times? Where do we go from here? The opposition is aware that there are many solutions to face astronomical tax liabilities due in part to huge penalties and interest on their arrears. In the past, and successive governments have done so, tax amnesties have been granted. Usually these amnesties involve a reduction in penalties. in order to give all citizens a chance to start with a clean slate. An SLP administration will enact legislation and remove all penalties and interest on outstanding liabilities, provided that all outstanding taxes are settled within a specified period. Once value-added tax is introduced, an SLP government will reduce taxation on working people by raising the income tax threshold for the payment of income tax from $18,000 annually to at least $21,000 annually over the next 5 years. This will mean that the thousands of St. Lucians who are earning less than $1,750 a month will not have to pay income tax. We are also aware that many citizens are intimidated by the tax department. Some feel helpless when they have issues of taxation with the Inland Revenue Department. Most are unable to pay accountants or lawyers to plead their cases or causes. They are on their own. We therefore propose to create the Office of Tax Ombudsman to intervene on behalf of taxpayers and assist them to resolve differences and disputes between them and the Inland Revenue Department. Madam Speaker, this budget will, as in the case of previous budgets, call for the award of numerous contracts. Contracts, the law. The Prime Minister and the Minister of Finance and the Member for Castries North will get another opportunity to exercise his favorite power, the power to issue contracts by direct purchase, that is, without bidding in the majority of cases. And the Member for Castries Southeast is smiling. But he's always critical. Since becoming Prime Minister and Minister of Finance, the Member for Castries North has developed an extraordinary appetite for issuing contracts by his own authority. I know that I will be told as usual, you did it too. But I defy anyone to show that in the last 5 years that I held office, that I issued as many contracts as issued by the current Prime Minister and the Minister of Finance. Let us do the addition. We estimate that in the last 4 years, the Minister of Finance has given direct purchase directives amounting to over $150 million, possibly climbing to $195 million. Possibly. Bravo. British Prime Minister asked whether he's broken the law. Well, well, well. Interesting, isn't it? Interesting. But the fact is, what has transpired is nothing short of scandalous. It is a naked abuse of power and authority. It is unfair on citizens of this country that all citizens cannot apply for contracts and be given the opportunity to be heard to determine whether they are successful or not. There is no equality of treatment in such behavior. Our Constitution requires to treat every citizen the same. Not some differently. Some are not more equal than others. All of them are equal. The Prime Minister says he broke no law. The Prime Minister says that he broke no law. The power which the Prime Minister uses is contained in Section 9 of the Procurement and Stalls Regulations, and he's right. It says, quote, "The minister may issue directions for the procurement of goods and services by tender or by direct purchase, and for the sale of salt by tender or direct sale. This is the regulation that is in convention.
Leave him alone.
He has too much to explain, you know. A little bit of history,
Madam Speaker.
When the financial consultant Alec Lazare, a former director of finance of Dominica, recommended the inclusion of this clause in the procurement and stores regulation, giving the Minister of Finance the authority to issue directives to the procurement of goods and services by direct purchase, the intention was that the power would be used in emergency situations and in instances where there were difficulties in locating more than one supplier of goods and services. Concededly, the aftermath of Hurricane Thomas was one such emergency. Are you going to tell me that the emergency existed months before Hurricane Thomas and continues to exist 3-4 months after Hurricane Thomas? The Minister for Finance is so intent at abusing his powers under the procurement and stores regulations that he issues direct purchases for the procurement of goods and services for amounts as low as $5,000. In fact, what he has done is to take away the administrative power of permanent secretaries and heads of departments, and has made the departmental tenders board and central tenders board almost redundant in the procurement process. I know you will have a problem with that. And don't forget, we have $2 million to account for. Now, you stay steady. A member for Miku North exposed all of you today. She made it clear that so far you have got $2 million each, and that you are getting, and she just whispered more, and that there's a further million on it too. So, take care. I know you don't want to go there, honorable member. But there are several examples of the abusive behavior. In one instance, Madam Speaker, the proprietor of this firm, and listen to the name, Madam Speaker, You Wash and Dry. The proprietor of this firm, You Wash and Dry, was given the contract to replace the roof of a segment of Victoria Hospital a few days after the roof of VH needed substantial repairs to be put in working order. Correct. However, one of the most interesting cases is one where the Minister of Finance issued two direct purchase orders in the total value, or to the total value of approximately $170,000 to procure equipment at one of the ministries from two different business entities. On the surface, it appears that he was sharing the law. However, when the due diligence was conducted, included seeking information from the registry of companies, it was revealed that both entities were owned by the same individual. Madam Speaker, you have asked me not to mention names, but this is deception of the highest order. I will not mention names in obedience. To your instruction. I will obey you, Madam Speaker, and will not mention the name of the proprietor. But at least I can provide you with the names of the two companies, Business Services Plus, Procurement Services International. One individual, two different companies, subterfuge.
Prime Minister is brave. The Prime Minister is brave. He's asking me, who are these people? But the member for Castries Southeast is anxious that I turn to contractual direct purchase. I'll oblige you. On December 16, 2010, the Prime Minister issued direct purchase approval post-Hurricane Thomas. And I'm going to mention a few. Some of them are in the public domain. Hippolyte Equipment Services, $421,767.29. Partial restoration of shock and water on bridges. Hippolyte Equipment Services, anchoring of Wasco's ductile iron pipes at Millet, $62,650. Yes. Partial restoration of Tumase Bridge Approach. I'm a member from Negro North. I don't know if she's aware. Hippolyte Equipment Services, $100,496 for the holders at the top of the bridge. Becker School Compound Cleanup, Hippolyte Equipment Services, $448,170.75. Excavation in respect of the restoration of Wasco's intake at Wabin Pass, Hippolyte Equipment Services, $109,000. Clearing of slides and drains in Becker and Mark, Live Up Equipment Services, $40,800. Excavation in respect of the restoration of Wasco's intake, Hippolyte Equipment Services, $216,450. Clearing of slides and drains in Becker and Mark, Heavy Machinery and Construction, $84,031.25. Provision for boulders for restoration works on the part of the Tarasque Incorporated, $607,190. Provision of boulders for restoration work for the Body Little, CCI, $107,500 because of an incident. Then 16th December. Now, this one you must listen to. Because there's a particular history with a member for Catholic Southeast. He's talking about that anything to do with his ministry will never have crossed over them. That is his vow, his sacred vow. But you see, there are different descriptions of cross over them. That is what. You lack time. And this is a contrast. Variation in the amount of ECC, 362,000. Yes, variation. Variation. No, don't be a writer. Variation in the amount of ECC, $362,824.35. Via direct award to Skelly Construction Services Limited for work up to the roadstone base layer of the Goodlands Access Road, bringing the overall contract price to EC $708,893.15. What is that? Ah, they extended the contract. Variation. They expanded on, but okay. Yes, to pray to your fault. No variation. And you are caught. Then, this is interesting. Direct award in favor of Millennium Contractors for the resurfacing of Union Hill Drop Road, Union Castries, in the sum of EC $105,000. Now that is the most intriguing award. Because when the company's registry is checked for the description of who owns that company, all we find is that it is a business name and the applicant there is the lawyer. He shall remain nameless. Then, interestingly, very interesting, direct award in favor of Curtis Clark for the resurfacing of Union Hilltop Road, Union Castries,
in a sum of $83,000 for this trap. Curtis Clark, trust me, the story is not ended there. Then we have endless other direct purchases. Dated December 22nd, clearing of slides and drains in Miller, Daniel Sipal, $360,595. Clearing of slides and drains at Dexler, Mark, Wapiton, Siwa Construction, $617,161. Clearing of slides and drains at Pontejac, Theo Williams, $606,996.57. Clearing of slides and drains at Bardi Lil, Hippolyte Equipment Services, $465,000. Construction of Bypass Road at Monreport, Collins Lynch, $166,000. Reinstatement of Wasco Intake at Vanna. Cost running cherry, $252,813. Clean of slides and drains at Bagatelle, Shelley Construction Services, $291,134. Clearing of slides and drains at General Shelley Construction Services, $449,181. And there's a very lucky gentleman. Clearing of fallen trees by use of chainsaw, Aaron Bureau, $47,102. Madam Speaker, I want you to look at these figures. Restoration works at Marshall Bridge, Hippolyte Equipment Services, $191,700. Reinstatement of Wasco Intake at Vanna, Hippolyte Equipment Services, $65,800. Clearing and slides and drains at Miles Bridge Souffre, honorable member. Paul Marsh, $64,925. Clearing of slides and drains at Montes Souffre, Isaac Joseph, $53,437. This is the local people. And there's nothing wrong in awarding contracts. Nothing wrong. But allow every solution to arise. That is the evil. And then construction of reinforced concrete, cantilever, and gravity retaining walls at Kiroshi. Fresh Start Construction Company Limited, $2,345,308.57. Construction of reinforced concrete culvert, crossing at Antdale Antlery. Fresh Start Construction Company Limited, $2,575,466.68. And you tell me that's not abuse? And you tell me that that is not abuse? There aren't other contractors in this country who are eligible for these contracts. But it turns out that the sole director, of Fresh Start Construction is one Peter Felicia, well known in the set of Hippolyte Equipment Services. The Lucia Labour Party will bring an end to this abuse, though. It will bring an end to this abuse. It will completely repeal and replace Section 9 of the Procurement and Stores Regulations and confine its application solely to emergency situations. It will introduce legislation to create an Office of Contractor General to monitor and investigate all contracts, whether by government or statutory boards, to ensure fairness, equity, and justice in this country. Madam Speaker, the member for Kashmir South East has been very busy and very active. Now it is his turn to clarify a few matters. And I know she will. Madam Speaker, I invite certain clarifications on the Minister of Communications and Roads, the member for Castries South East. It is my understanding that there are delays in the construction of the Angel Gates Road. That one is a painful construction. Very painful. This contract, as honorable members would know from previous engagements in the House, was awarded to Adfors and Mining, the minister's favorite company, with whom he has defined relationships. I need clarification to the following. What is the involvement of Herzog, the American company that allegedly came down to this country to work at the airport? What is the involvement in that project? Do they have Do the delays with the construction of the road have anything to do with the failure of A&M to safeguard? Is there a problem? And the third question. Bearing in mind the delays, Mr. Minister, is it true that in an attempt to avoid cost overruns, the government has decided to remove certain components from the scope of the contract? Have you told the member from the staff? Can you clarify? Well, maybe you might want to answer one question now. Have you recommended changing the scope of the contract? Yes or no? Understand? Hold your time. But I have a few other questions for you, Mr. Minister. Who knows, the time may come when you have no chance but to answer. Exactly. But you will have to answer. Now, Mr. Minister, I would like to find out, Mr. Minister, because I see a sharing on the estimate. Three projects. Along Busquets Highway Rehabilitation Phase 1, a payment and an estimate of $2,816,720. I take it that that is going to A&M for favorite contractor. Along Busquets Highway Rehabilitation Phase 2, that one is yet to be explained, $1,174,800. East Coast Road Rehabilitation, $8,342,000 budgeted. The estimated cost is $32,224,598. All I ask is whether the Ministry of Communication intend to proceed to authorize payments on these contracts without a government guarantee. That's all I ask. I want you to confirm whether you will authorize payments or advise the Minister of Finance to authorize payments on these contracts without a government guarantee. While I am in the business of contract, I regret, Madam Speaker, that I did not have an opportunity to hear the member for Babylon. This is a member who intrigued me. Throughout the delivery of the budget by the Prime Minister, he was very sad, self-absorbed, preoccupied. And I really wondered
what may have been occupying his attention. But the news was not good in the budget, neither was the performance in the agricultural sector. I do. I find it so fascinating. You need a little more to confuse me, my friend. You need a little more to confuse me. A lot more than that. But you know what? Could you clarify the situation with the other swine before? You may have answered the question. But I want you to clarify whether there is any truth to the fact that the Taiwanese were withdrawn from me, and why is it that the government of Fiducia has had to pay the contractor over $1 million from the consolidated fund of Taiwan. Now, this is one. And maybe the right questions are not put to you. But come on. Use another colleague of yours and speak to your colleague. You can ask the Minister for Communications and work to respond on your behalf. No. Man, please, I don't want to invite him off your book. Madam Speaker, I think I've said enough on this budget. I have had the opportunity to be at the nerve center of the government, Madam Speaker. I have also had the opportunity to observe from a distance, sometimes from this parliamentary chamber. I have not been ashamed, although some may feel that it is a subject of ridicule to say that in opposition I have learned a lot. I have learned about new issues of governance. I have learned that an opposition must be treated with respect. I have learned that it is wrong for a sitting government, to deny a former prime minister security at his home when a cabinet conclusion said that he had to have security for 18 months. I vow never ever. And I hope that the party that I lead will make sure that these basic courtesies are extended. What do you mean, come on? What do you mean, come on, Prime Minister? What do you mean, come on? From where I sit, I watch as the actions for which we were attacked, vilified and condemned are repeated this time with impunity. No wonder our people have become so distrustful and cynical. Some of these problems go to our tradition of governance, and we have to go to the root of our problems. That is why. What am I doing in security? I see. And your prime minister now has how many? Right. Good. So you're the least person to be afraid of. That is why we will, at the right time, introduce a code of conduct to guide ministerial behavior. Introduce a manual of procedures to guide the business of cabinet. Such a manual will help to prevent the corrupt behavior that occurred in the Tuxedo Villains affair. You went to a court, and you had to pay the taxes after. And Madam Speaker, what about the furniture of my home? My friend, you know what? If you're so brave in what you say, just stay it outside. You can't stay it outside, though. You can't stay it outside, though. You're so brave. Go and stay it outside, and I'll give you the chance to prove it.
Members.
Madam Speaker.
Let me say in conclusion too.
Members?
Yeah, he never said. He's a coward, you know. He's a coward.
Madam Speaker, we fully support the reform of the budgetary process to allow for debates on the estimated expenditure, but we believe that such debate should take place at least an entire month prior to the budget release. This way the expenditure proposed by government will be more thoroughly scrutinized. In this address, Madam Speaker, we have looked at the abuses of power, abuses of authority. We have looked at unfair treatment needed out of solutions. We have noted that key contracts in this country are awarded to specific companies, to specific individuals. We believe that a necessary condition for a good governance is a highly skilled and motivated public service. Currently, there is no institution responsible for improving the skills based in the service. If we are to create a public service that will denounce corruption, resist abuse of power, the exercise of authority, then we must empower our public officers with the tools. The SLP government will therefore establish an accredited public service training school affiliated with a recognized university college of public sector training and development institute. The school will be responsible for providing public servants with the skill level of skills and continuous training that they require to function in an ever-changing landscape. It is our intention, eventually, Madam Speaker, to transform this school into a regional training institution. Madam Speaker, it is not often that we go to the judgment, but only study. We understand. We do so willingly, and we ask our people to render their verdict. That being said, Madam Speaker, the few minutes which I have left, I want to touch on certain matters relating to that. Madam Speaker, for the last 4 years, on every occasion I have come to this house, I raise the plight of the fishermen of your home. Every 4 years. Prior to coming to this budget debate, I had the opportunity, Madam Speaker, to dialogue with fishermen again. And this is what I have been told. For the better part of 2 months, there has been no water at the fisheries complex because the Beaufort Town Council owes a bill of $9,000 and is unable to pay the bill to ASCO. So the sanitary conditions that are required for the sale of fish no longer exist. The fishermen are back washing fish with seawater within their tanks. Then there is the vexed issue of outstanding payments. A few weeks ago, I went on radio and pointed out that it was unfair to keep the payments of the fishermen away from them. And we are not dealing with pittance, Madam Speaker. We are dealing with amounts like $60,000, $80,000. And the minister knows full well the fishermen in Beaufort who would be entitled to be paid $60,000, $80,000. He knows them well. When I made the statement, an officer of the Fish Marketing Corporation denied what I said. I pointed out that checks were issued by the Fish Marketing Corporation that time. There was no money in the account. I was virtually accused of lying. But yet, You can find several fishermen who are prepared to testify that such checks did bounce and provide examples of them. Today, the fishermen of Newport are owed 1.5 million dollars by the complex. 1.5 million. And it was only yesterday for the first time that we were told, that NDC is no longer responsible for the fishing complex, but rather it is the Ministry of Agriculture and it is the Minister. The Minister accepted responsibility. So now, the message that I have for the people of Newport, the fishermen of Newport, is that it is the Minister of Agriculture who is responsible. Now, Mr. Minister, I know you think ill of the people of Newport and the fishermen of Newport. I know that. That's okay. They can stomach it. But you must make sure they're paid. And I want to pay them within 2 weeks. And you heard what I said, 2 weeks. I repeat what I said. You must pay the fishermen of Newport within 2 weeks. I understand that for this government, Newport is in the hot box. That it is in the hot box. Once again, I have to ask the Minister of Youth and Sports whether, despite the proud tradition of Newport and the South, that Newport must continue to suffer. It's now almost 2 years that the roof of the pavilion has been removed. Almost 2 years. And cannot be replaced. And has not been replaced. Though increasingly, the facility is being used for national activities. It's over a year and a half that the fence surrounding the basketball court and netball court is down. No attention. Rocking on the ground. And then, of course, there's a great wall of tigers surrounding the place here. $50,000 disappeared from those funds. We don't know where it disappeared to, but the wall remains incomplete and untidy, requiring some basic finishing. I must ask you, Mr. Minister, who controls the playing field in Newport, and whether there are some new rules being introduced in the management of sports in this country. I was not aware that when sporting clubs utilize playing fields, that they were required to pay a fee. I was not aware of that. Recently, the town clerk of Newport wrote to an organization as follows, an organizer of sports. Council favorably acknowledges receipt of your letter dated 22nd March 2001. Requesting use of the Philip Martinet grounds for staging weekend cricket competition from 26 March to 30th April 2001. A fee of $150 plus a refundable deposit shall be paid per game. The deposit is refunded on condition that the grounds are cleaned after each game. Per game. So if you organize a tournament, a series of matches, then you have to find yourself paying for each match that is played. And this is how we really want to encourage our young people and want to invest in our young people. Madam Speaker, I regret that the Minister for NDC is not here with us today.
But the people of Newport have always had an uneasy relationship with the National Development Corporation. The National Development Corporation cannot cite one project in Newport that it has done for the benefit of the Newport people. The only project which would have been financed by NDC, which was supposed to commence before the last general election, was promptly cancelled by the government after the general election, the construction of a craft market for vendors in Newport. And yet the indiscretions of NDC continued. They don't reply to letters. Not even a request to make available a lot of land, a tiny piece of land to build a bus shelter in Larissa could be attended. Don't know if it is arrogance or something else. I don't know if it's arrogance. And then it is well known that over several years there are people in Newport who are occupying government land for generations after generation. That is why we created a program to empower them by making land available to them. But to get a simple connection of water, they have to get not only the permission of NDC to make a connection, but they must show proof that they have the permission. And what NDC does is to compel and force them to enter into lease agreements or arrangements, which in a majority of cases they never grant. Why are you like that? Why are you getting involved in historical matters that you know nothing about? When the Labour Party was in office, it removed it. When you came back in, you reinforced it. That is why this morning, a fisherman from Sufre had to call me and ask me why the member for Babano is saying and going way back to Hurricane Island and say fishermen never got assistance. It is not true because that's part of the government. Go and ask Peter Josie, what are you talking about? That's why you tell me. That's why you tell me it's not true that the fishermen are complaining. And then, what is the NDC doing these days? To control squatting. To control squatting. NDC has been systematically destroying the homes of people whom they believe are squatting. Now, it is not my business, and I avoid it all the time, to disclose affairs of clients. I will not do so. But I know cases where NDC has had to pay for homes they have destroyed. How could NDC justify destroying the homes of the citizens of Newport? Homes that they have spent years in building. Even when the people have lived on the land for years and they're trying to renovate their homes, officials of the NDC intimidate them and stop them to repair their homes. Are we justified it? We justify it. We think it's right. I mentioned the poor program earlier on. Some days ago there was a meeting of proud officials in the kitchen. And I want to go over the proud program. This program, in my view, was one of the most important programs in the history of this country. Most important program in helping to empower people to own land. I don't care whether it is this government or the former government. I don't care since they don't like names that Labour Party gives the program, they just put the name Crown and they put some other name. What mattered under the program was that ordinary solutions were being given opportunity to own the land that they had been existing or living on for years, and they were being given or they were allowed to purchase that land at heavily discounted rates. This government has said no, and the program has been interrupted.
precisely, and I've raised this matter in the house before, nearly every rep in this parliament have problems in the country with crown lands that are illegally occupied. All of us face those problems. And Crown was a program that was systematic. It started in Bedford, resolved problems in Bedford. It resolved problems in his constituency. It resolved some problems in Labrie. It resolved some problems in Chai. It resolved some problems in Aritus, Latuni. That
drive and enthusiasm for the program has disappeared. Once again, we back to the same old problem. Madam Speaker, no part of this country seems to be immune from the problems of water. Remember, Francis Ray Henry expatiated. Well, he has a problem when he goes back to both Angela Ray and to Canary because they're waiting for him. You know why they're waiting for him? Because he lied. I withdraw. I withdraw. Immediately. He was economical with the truth, man. Because you see, the people of Anstruther are not getting any water, neither the people of Canary is getting any water. And they're waiting for you to explain yourself. But the problem is that all of us are faced with the problem, and no doubt the people of your fort suffer repeatedly that when there's a slightest rain, water supplies have to be interrupted. Now, it is in that regard that intervention in resolving this problem of water supply are always welcome. But there is a little matter that the minister needs to resolve for me and resolve for the constituency of people. It is this. Some years ago, just before, a couple of years before the general election, the government of St. Lucia Tuwasco invested over $1.3 million in procuring, I believe, equipment to purify water in the deepwater area. It was intended that this equipment would resolve the existing problem. For reasons that remain unclear, that equipment was never operationalized. And what remains confusing is whether there were technical problems in putting the equipment together. And as a result, the equipment costing, as I said, $1.3 million, went to it. I am not certain what the situation is, but I'm sure the member would want to clarify. Then too, there is a creeping problem of the abandonment of the estate of the factory shells in Newport. Day by day, factories are closing in Newport and abandoning the shells that they once occupied. In fact, within the next few weeks, I believe Fenwall, a company that has been in existence in Newport for years and has contributed significantly to the Newport community, will be closing. That factory shell will also be left empty.
Beaufort is now littered with empty factory shells as some companies move out and go elsewhere. Yet it translates losses of jobs. Not just for Beaufort, but for Mito South, Mito North, for that reason to sell. The time has come for a proper appraisal to be done of this situation to determine what use should be put, what should be made of in respect of these factory shells. It is clear that the purpose for which they were originally built cannot now be satisfied because the problem of competition. We are losing our market share in the global competition and factories are moving elsewhere. So what are we to do with the hundreds of hundreds of factory space that now lie idle in Beaufort because of abandonment? As the factories move out, and you see the landlord is not interested in repairing, so these buildings have become unsightly. Madam Speaker, I believe that a proper appraisal, as I said, needs to be done of the industrial estates in Beaufort to determine where we go from here. Whether these shells ought to be converted to other uses. For example, whether after all these years we should divide these shells into cubicles for small business operators so that they can make use of them. These are the kind of issues that inevitably arise. Madam Speaker, it has been an interesting cycle for the people of Beaufort. There have been two major government projects, or three major government projects in that constituency. First was the repair of the health center, which was programmed on the funds that the Labour Party had arranged years before. Beaufort was programmed to be the last health center, and in fact the government made sure it was the last health center to be repaired, but it was not. Then there's the Great Wall of Taipei surrounding the Beaufort field, and God, which welcomes now everybody to the town of Beaufort. And tightly, badly needing completion. And then recently, under the constituency program, a piece of concrete and a couple of grains of insertion are constructed in the airport. I guess we have to say thank you for small mercies, don't we? That's not in my constituency, and by the way, you should not go there. You should stay away from that. All right. So we should say thanks to small work. That is all that has been done in Beaufort South, except the occasional stipend of $30,000 for road properties. But I want you to understand that the Beaufort people have resilience. Beaufort people understand. They know that once this government is in office, they will suffer persecution and discrimination. They know that. They know that. Not even bothering to bother replying to you. You don't deserve it now. And I'll tell you this. That the hour of reckoning is coming. And this government, this Tikanal government, this Tikanal budget, this Tikanal approach to the development of this country, these haphazard short-term measures with no vision, no hope for the future, people of this country
the past judgment. And the hour of judgment is approaching. Thank you, madam.
Thank you.